Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, September 2023 edition, The History of the American Frontier. Spur Talk by Max Evans. The day Bill McDonald rode over the hill leading to the Appaloosa, Slim and I were repairing the corrals. Slim was running Pete Coleman's little ranch about 3 miles south of Cow Springs, New Mexico. I was just a snotty-nosed, freckled-faced kid at the time. Bill rode up and said, "Howdy, fellers." It made me feel right proud to be included among the fellers. I think Slim and I both sensed something wrong when Bill first spoke. "How are things going, Bill?" Slim asked. "Not so good. Little feller here. Throwed my boy," he said. "I think his leg's busted." "The hell you say?" "The third time this week," Bill said. "Can't understand it. The wife has gone into Santa Fe for the doc. It's pretty bad, and we was afraid to move him till we got a holt of the doc." The big Appaloosa stood there as gentle as a milk cow. A man couldn't imagine he'd buck at all. According to his size, he was sure named Funny. Bill's boy, Herod, started calling him Little Feller when he was a colt and the name stuck. He was especially big for this part of the country, where the main horse used was the small Spanish Mustang. Little Feller must have weighed around 1150 and was powerfully muscled. I knew that in his early days, the Appaloosa was prized by Indian chieftains, not only for his unusual markings, but because of his toughness. "Slim," Bill said, "I've got to get on back, but I sure as all hell wish you'd give this old pony a working over." Slim said, "All right, Bill, I'll see what I can do," and reached for the Appaloosa's rein. Slim kept looking Little Feller over, and Bill rode off, and I heard him mumbling to himself. Then he said aloud, "Can't figure it out. That horse is 4 years old, and he never bucked a jump all the time Herod was breaking him. But," he added, "I've seen him that way before. If you don't take it out of him quick, you've got an outlawed horse on your hands." Slim was one of the best horse breakers in this part of the country. You could hardly find an outfit around that didn't have a horse or two he had tamed. He led the Appaloosa into the corral we had been repairing. He felt around on Little Feller's back to be sure there weren't any stickers or sore spots. There weren't. Little Feller didn't even flinch when Slim threw his saddle on his back. Then Slim stepped up on him, sure of himself, but careful just the same. He eased the pony into a trot, then gradually worked him into more speed. Around and around the corral they went. He watched closely, and all the time his right hand was on the saddle horn. Slim wasn't a rodeo rider. He used that horn for what it was put on a saddle for. The sweat broke out on Little Feller, but he didn't buck at all. In fact, he hadn't even humped up. When Slim stepped off, he said, "Saddle up Red. We're going for a ride." Red was a sorry old sorrel horse that wasn't fit for anything except to keep around the house to wrangle the other horses on. I saddled him up. Slim swung an arm at a deep arroyo that ran all the way to a long mesa about 2 miles off. He said, "Now, if Little Feller heads for that arroyo, you run in front of him and beat him across the face with your hat. Anything to keep him from jumping in that thing." Little Feller foxtrotted along easy-like. We rode right by his side, between him and the arroyo. We covered a quarter of a mile without seeing anything of interest, but a lizard that raced about looking for shade. Then it happened. A ragged patch of air was expelled from Little Feller's insides. He snorted and went from me about 4 long, ground-pounding jumps, then sucked back. I knew then this was the way he had thrown Herod McDonald. But Slim was ready, and though I could see the strain in his face and arms, he stayed put. Little Feller got mad then. He bellowed like a bull buffalo and ran nearly over the top of the sorrel and me. I was scared half to death, but managed to spur Old Red in front of him, cutting away from the arroyo. Every time little feller went up, he bellered. Every time his feet hit, the ground shook and he left deep tracks in the earth. And every time Slim's head was snapped back and all his bones absorbed the shock, but he was still on. He hadn't a chance to spur much at first, but now he had the rhythm of the horse, so he bogged it to little feller. A small patch of hair went into the wind every time one of Slim's heavy spurs hit. Then, as suddenly as little feller had started, he quit. I rode up, proud of Slim, and said, "You've got him whipped. I bet he don't never buck again." "Hell," Slim said, "he's just getting warmed up." Slim was sure right. We had ridden maybe another 100 yards when the old devil jumped into a dead run. Just as he reached his peak of speed, he bogged his head and went straight up. I could hear the whomp of his belly and guts as he came down. Slim's hat went off. I knew then things were tough. I'd seen Slim pull that hat right down over his ears when we left the corral. Little feller bucked straight ahead with those high-power-driven jumps. Then he bucked back again, but in a different direction than before. Slim almost lost a stirrup, but managed to pull back with the Appaloosa. Again, little feller stopped as suddenly as he started. Slim yelled for me to get his hat. He stepped off to lighten the cinch. A lot of lard had already melted under that horse's tough hide, and I could see quite a bit of daylight between his belly and the leather flank strap. Slim didn't waste any time. He jerked his hat down even farther on his head and climbed back aboard. I couldn't make myself believe that little feller could go on with it any longer, but I didn't say anything. I knew Slim wasn't in the best of spirit at the time. Little feller stumbled along until he reared right straight up in the air. If Slim hadn't yelled like a wild Comanche and whopped him over the head with his open hand, I figure little feller would have fallen back on top of him. When the horse's front feet hit dirt again, Slim had his hand back on the saddle horn. Don't think for 1 minute that he was ashamed of pulling leather. A working cowboy doesn't like to walk home when he's miles out in the pastures. He learns damn quick to stay on any way he can. Little feller started kicking back with his hind legs just as his front dug into the ground. A back kicker is one of the meanest buckers in the world to ride. While Slim's body would follow the forward motion, the back kick would catch him right in the middle of it and wrench him hard the other way. Slim's face was white as death. He could see the leaders in his neck standing out and the muscles knotted where his jaws were clamped together. Then just as we rounded the mesa point, I saw the bloodstream from Slim's nose. I wanted, worse than anything else in the world, to yell to him to quit, but I had been taught to keep my mouth shut on such matters, so I didn't say a word. Little feller got within 6 inches of a fence that Slim had told me to watch. He turned back, more from Slim's heavy spur in his neck than he did from Red and me. When he stopped this time, I could see that he was mighty tired. He stood with his head down, legs apart, and his lather-covered sides worked in and out as his lungs pulled for more air. Slim sat up on him, as if he didn't know that the blood had circled around the corners of his mouth and was oozing down under his chin. His shirt was sprayed with red splatters. I couldn't imagine even then that a horse could buck that far and that hard, or that a cowboy could stay on his back that long and live. But there they were. At the time, I was sure of only one thing. I knew Slim was going to get killed. It had boiled down to some sort of personal battle between the man and the horse. Without saying a word, Slim reached out and raked the rowels of his spurs from high in the neck right back to the flanks. They left a track all the way. Little feller answered with a sideways jump. He bucked slowly, but just as hard as he had in the beginning. Slim never stopped the music of his spurs. They seemed to me as if they were separate from his tired body. We were at a gate when this session ended. I could see now that blood was coming out of the corners of Slim's mouth, as well as his nose. They stood there for a long time. I started to get down to open the gate, but Slim said, "No, I'll get it." I really don't know why he wanted to open the gate, unless it was just to show that Appaloosa that he could still walk. He wobbled on his boot heels, and little feller moved stiff-legged through the gate. His shoulders were marked a lot from the spurring. Slim got back on, but barely. His leg didn't quite swing over far enough. If little feller had been fresh, he would have lost his rider right there. But he wasn't fresh. Slim spoke, and I could tell by the rasp of his voice that his throat was mighty dry. "This is it, you son of a bitch." But in his cussing, I could hear respect. The Appaloosa made only two more high, hard, honest jumps. I could hear his guts beat at his sides. Slim winced away from the jar when he hit. Then he struck him with the spurs once. He swung out his legs out wide and dug the steel in where the horse's neck joined his shoulders. It popped, almost like a gun, only not as sharp. The horse stopped again. There was no need to go any further. We turned around and came back through the same gate, only this time I opened it. That night, and for several, there in the bedrolls, I could hear Slim moan, roll, and talk to little feller. The next day, Slim had me ride little feller back over to McDonald's. When I asked him if it would be all right, he said, "Why, sure." He was right. But I wonder how he knew. Maybe little feller had told him that day over by the gate that he'd never buck again. One thing I know, if the horse did say anything, Slim sure would have understood, because he's the kind that talks horse language. True West Magazine, September 2023 edition. In the Lens of History by Stuart Rosebrook. A century ago, the state of Montana was still one of the youngest states. The Rocky Mountain and Great Plains state received its star on Old Glory in 1889, 25 years after it had been made a territory carved out of the vast, lightly settled western lands first acquired by the United States in the Louisiana Purchase. From 1870 to 1920, Montana grew from just over 20,000 American settlers to nearly 550,000 residents. The earliest pioneers to the territory included Catholic missionaries, miners, fur trappers, traders, cattlemen, and town builders. Violence was ever present in the early days of Montana history. Lakota leader Red Cloud defeated the U.S. Army in his war to control the tribe's territory along the Bozeman Trail in the mid-1860s. But despite the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868, war continued and culminated in the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But in this vast territory, violence was not just relegated to battles and skirmishes with the Indian tribes. Vigilantism took the place of law and order in the mining camps and ranching communities across the territory until statehood. With no shortage of historic source material, Hollywood producer Taylor Sheridan mined the post-Civil War history of the West and Montana for his first Yellowstone prequel series, 1883. Just a year after 1883's debut on Paramount Plus, Sheridan returned with 1923, the much-anticipated expansion of the Yellowstone universe. Just over a century ago, the real Montana was still recovering economically and socially from World War I, as drought and economic recession began to cripple the young state's five most important industries: mining, ranching, railroading, logging, and farming. On the state's seven Indian reservations, poverty was pervasive, and Native residents were still not considered American citizens. The passage of the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act was still a year away from being the law of the land. Sheridan, one of the greatest storytellers in television and film history, knows where to mine for drama. And in 1923, he did not shy away from the best or the worst of America's and Montana's past. As K. Ross Toole wrote in 1959 in Montana, An Uncommon Land, the past and present in Montana merge uncomfortably for the liberal and the conservative alike. It is easier to ignore the past or to deny that it has any meaning for the present and the future than to be confronted with the unclear composite in which an approximation of truth shifts and moves in time. Ranchers and homesteaders. In the 1920s, drought forced thousands of Montana homesteaders and ranchers to abandon their dreams, while those left behind fought for what grass and water was available for their stock and farms. Towns and tourism. Between 1910 and 1920, Montana's population grew 46%. Railroads helped fuel the growth of homesteaders in rural areas, while the state's mining towns grew with the nation's industrial need for copper. Butte was the only city with over 25,000 residents, while 90 Big Sky towns had 2,500 citizens or fewer. Tourism also grew after Glacier National Park, founded in 1910, joined Yellowstone as two of the state's most popular destinations. Freighters and surveyors. In Montana in 1923, surveyors were still a few years away from mapping out the U.S. highway system, which was yet to be funded, let alone be built. National railways and short lines crisscrossed the state, but wagons, surreys, and horses were still the primary mode of transportation and freighting. Montana's Native People. In 1923, Montana's seven Indian tribes made up just 2% of the state's population. The majority of approximately 11,000 indigenous residents lived on seven reservations, but many of the Indian children lived apart from their families at eight boarding schools. The 1920s was a difficult time for all Montanans, but for the state's native peoples, it was an especially challenging decade, marked by an increase in poverty and disease. Ironically, reservation life would improve during the Great Depression and World War II. Mining and industry. Between the 1880s and 1920s, Montana's mining towns, such as Butte, modernized ahead of the rest of the state. Immigrants made up most of the labor force in the Big Sky State, and Montana had the largest Irish population west of the Mississippi. True West Magazine, September 2023 edition. Miles City, Montana, by Peter Corbett. Miles City was prime for the 4th of July. The fledgling town in eastern Montana Territory celebrated with music from Fort Keogh's 5th Infantry Band. The soldiers and townies enjoyed foot races, fireworks, speeches, and a baseball game. The Miles City Nine beat the Fort Keogh batsmen 23-14. The Yellowstone Journal of 1869 reported on the celebration held in a handsome grove on the Tongue River. It noted the bucolic scene was hardly suggestive of the howling wilderness that Miles City was a few months earlier. This was 3 years after the disastrous Battle of the Little Bighorn and about 100 miles away as the crow flies. In the 1880s, Fort Keogh's army troops went on to play a pivotal role in subduing the Sioux, protecting railroad surveyors, settlers, and supply lines to Miles City and beyond. The town is named for Colonel Nelson A. Miles, a commander of Fort Keogh and a key figure in the Indian Wars. Historian Joseph James Warhank, in his master's thesis, summarized Fort Keogh's importance in settling the Montana Territory in the 1880s. Montana went from a vast and unmapped territory to a settled state, with farmers and ranchers replacing the soldiers as the dominant force in eastern Montana, he wrote. Fort Keogh closed in 1908, but was used as a remount station, later supplying horses for World War I. More than a century later, Miles City is an authentic western town of 8,500 at the confluence of the Yellowstone and Tongue Rivers. It is known for its bucking horse sale, Range Riders Museum, Waterworks Art Museum, an historic saddlery, and an impressive collection of historic buildings. The Bucking Horse Sale is held over 4 days on the third weekend in May. The Bucking Bronc Auction is the main event, but the Western Celebration includes a concert, parade, horse racing, and top bronc riders competing for big prize money. Miles City's first formal sale of the unruly horses was held in 1951. This year, close to 14,000 visitors showed up with several hundred motorhomes and others camping in tents at the fairgrounds, said Terry Fandrich, Miles City Chamber of Commerce spokeswoman. A cornerstone of Miles City history is the Range Riders Museum, established in 1939. The original log building is 2,800 square feet, and there are more than a dozen historic buildings with exhibits on Plains Indians, ranching, railroads, brands, barbed wire, and Fort Keogh. Another cultural draw is the Waterworks Art Museum, housed in the city's 1910 water plant on the Yellowstone River. The historic building hosts a Western art roundup that coincides with the Bucking Horse Sale. The museum's photography collection includes works by noted Indian photographer Edward S. Curtis, Evelyn Cameron, who captured the frontier life in eastern Montana, and L.A. Huffman, a photographer at Fort Keogh, starting in 1879. With all the ranching and horse wrangling in eastern Montana, Miles City became a hub of saddle craftsmen. As many as 40 saddle makers were practicing their craft in the 1930s. Miles City Saddlery, established in 1910, is one of the only ones left, Fandrich said. The store can outfit any cowboy or cowgirl with a saddle, boots, belts, hats, western wear, and leather goods. Miles City is also home to the Montana Bar, Bison Bar, and Montana Theater, which has a vacation rental apartment above the colorful marquee. The Bison Bar, established in 1900, stands out for its colorful sign with a bison outlined in neon. The nearby Montana Bar also has an impressive neon sign, shaped like the state of Montana. The bar has been serving patrons for 115 years, and the back bar was delivered by steamboat. Montana Bar has mosaic tile on the floor, a stamped tin ceiling, and a bullet hole in a leaded glass partition from a long-ago gunfight. It's stunning, Fandrich said of the Montana Bar. It is still very original. True West Magazine, September 2023 edition. Amber Waves of Grain and Flowers by Sherry Monahan. Kansas is still the breadbasket of America. Kansas pioneers knew their land was perfect for growing corn and wheat and an abundance of beautiful yellow sunflowers. While Kansans harvested wheat very early on, production statistics weren't tracked until 1866. That same year, about 1,300 bushels of wheat were produced. 20 years later, the number increased to 15,000, and by 1900, it jumped to 78,000. Turkey red wheat, an ancestor of much of the wheat grown in Kansas, is believed to have been brought over by Russian immigrants in the 1870s and did very well. Due to the amount of wheat grown in Kansas, it's not surprising that flour and grain mills were abundant across the state. Two companies with historic ties remain in business today. Hoffman Grist Mill was started by Swiss immigrant Christian Hoffman, who immigrated to America in 1855. He moved to Kansas 2 years later and opened his mill in 1869 along the banks of the Smoky River in what was called Loudon Falls. By 1872, the area became the town of Enterprise, where his mill grew rapidly and merged with many other mills. Hoffman was a pioneer in using turkey red wheat and was one of the first to use it in Kansas. He shared this in 1900. Experience soon demonstrated that it was a hardy wheat, resisting drought and dry weather. It became apparent to our firm that it was worthy of a careful test as to its milling and bread-making qualities. Such tests were made, and we found it was far superior. Hoffman's shipped flour around the world until 1929 when it went out of business. In 2016, the mill was revived at a nearby location where the same historic Turkey red wheat is milled today using historic equipment similar to what Hoffman used. The Hudson Milling Company was started by Gustav Krug in 1904 in Hudson. The company was reorganized due to financial problems in 1909 and became the Stafford County Flour Mills. It was known for Hudson cream flour and an illustration of a Jersey cow on its bags. Many pioneers believed that the Jersey cow produced the best milk and cream, so Krug incorporated it and the word cream to symbolize the white richness and smooth texture of his flour. The company continues the tradition today. Sunflowers are abundant in Kansas. During early frontier days, pioneers used sunflower seeds and oil for a variety of things, including chicken feed, shampoo, and cough elixirs. Around 1879, Kansas newspapers reported that Russia was creating a palatable oil from sunflowers. During the 1890s, the idea of using the seeds for human consumption began to emerge. While some home cooks experimented with the seeds and oil, use wasn't widespread. The Democratic Messenger in Eureka, Kansas, reported, "The use of sunflower seeds for food is suggested. Confections and other articles of diet made from this food will soon be placed before the public. Who knows but that we may find in this product a welcome addition to our present food supply?" One young Kansas woman who wasn't impressed with sunflowers went to her local market in May 1879 to get some flower seeds. The clerk told her he had some beautiful seeds to choose from and that some of them were the nicest climbers and would cover her house by July. A Leavenworth newspaper printed the story. The clerk said, "They will make it look almost like paradise." She confirmed what he said, and he added, "Yes, they will. You don't know how they will improve the looks of your house." Upon hearing that, she replied, "But I won't take any. Just as soon as they made the old house look any better, the landlord would come around and raise the rent on us. I guess I won't buy anything but sunflower seeds and a stalk or two of catnip." Recipe: Sally Lunn bread. 1 packet, active dry yeast. 2.5 cups heritage wheat flour. 1 cup milk. 3 tablespoons butter, cut into small pieces. 1 tablespoon sugar. 1/2 teaspoon salt. 1 egg. Place milk in a saucepan and heat to 120 to 130 degrees. Transfer to a large bowl and add the yeast and stir until dissolved. Add remaining ingredients and beat with a spoon until dough pulls cleanly away from the sides of the bowl and is smooth. Loosely cover the bowl with plastic wrap and let the dough rise in a warm place about 1 hour or until doubled in size. Grease or spray a loaf pan. Stir down dough with a spoon and pour into pan. Cover with plastic wrap. Let it rise in a warm place about 30 minutes or until dough is about 1 inch below the top of the pan. Bake loaf at 350 degrees for 25 to 30 minutes or until golden brown. Immediately remove from pan using a knife to loosen edges. Serve with butter. Recipe adapted from the Kansas Home Cookbook, 1874. True West Magazine, September 2023 edition. Chalk Level Shootout by Bob Bozbell. The Youngers versus the Pinkertons. The Bushwhackers score a goal. Shot down in the Missouri wilds. Based on the research of John Langelier and Jack McPhee. March 17, 1874. Around 2:10 p.m., the Snuffer family and John and Jim Younger are sitting down for dinner at Theodric Snuffer's homestead. As they eat, the Youngers hear horses coming up the lane, so they quickly scramble up a ladder into the attic. Peering through a crack between those logs, they see two strangers telling Old Man Snuffer they're cattle buyers. One of the riders asks Snuffer for directions to Widow Sims or Sims' house, as she advertised livestock for sale. Snuffer points the way, but the two ride off in the wrong direction. John becomes suspicious and wants to follow them. Jim demurs, stressing that he isn't looking for trouble, and he sits down to finish his meal. John presses his argument, pointing out that both strangers are too well armed to be simple cattle buyers, and that the younger of the two looked nervous. Jim finally gives in and agrees to accompany his younger brother. The two gather their horses from the Snuffer shed and gave chase. 3/4 of a mile up the road, the two cattle buyers, Lewis Lull and Ed Daniels, join up with James Wright, who is from the area and stayed behind because he was afraid the Snuffers would recognize him. The trio converse about their search for the James Younger gang while riding their horses at a slow gait. When the Youngers approach on horseback, Wright pulls his pistol, spurs his horse, and gallops away, cutting across a field as fast as his horse can carry him, ironically heading east toward Widow Sims's house. Jim orders Wright to stop, and when he didn't, Jim fires a pistol ball that takes off Wright's hat. John has both barrels of his double-barreled shotgun cocked. He covers Lull and Daniels until Jim rejoins them. The Youngers order the two strangers to give up their guns. Both men comply, dropping the revolvers on the road. Jim dismounts to gather the weapons, which include Lull's English-made .43-caliber Tranter, a Pinkerton standard issue. Holding up the exotic pistol for his brother to see, Jim says, "John, these are damn fine guns. It's sure nice of these boys to make us a present of them." Jim then turns back to the prisoners and asks, "Where are you fellas from?" "We're from Osceola," Lull replies. "What are you doing out here?" "Just rambling around." John cuts in, "You sure you're not detectives looking for someone?" He tells them detectives have been up here hunting them all the time, and they are going to stop it. "I am no detective," Daniel said. "I can show you who I am and where I belong." One of the Youngers admits to having met Daniels in town, so he turns to Lull and demands, "What the hell are you riding around here with all them pistols for?" "Good God," Lull pleads. "Is not every man wearing them that is traveling, and have I not as much the right to wear them as anyone else?" "Hold on, young man," John barks. "We don't want any of that." John lowers his shotgun for a moment. One report says John was trying to quiet his horse. With John's attention diverted, Lull reaches behind and pulls out a small No. 2 Smith & Wesson pistol and fires. Lull's horse lurches forward just as the bullet strikes John's neck. Reacting, John pulls the trigger on his shotgun and the pellets hit Lull in the shoulder and arm. Lull barely manages to stay in the saddle as his horse explodes down the road. On horseback, Daniels attempts to follow suit, but Jim shoots him in the neck. Daniels falls off the back of his mount onto the roadway. Down the road, Lull has no control over his horse as it jumps into the bushes and the trees. Lull later says he tried to get a hold of the reins with his right hand to bring him on the road, but John rode by me and fired 2 shots at me, one of which took effect in my left side, and I lost control of my horse, and he turned into the brush, and a small tree struck me and knocked me out of the saddle. Meanwhile, Jim rolls Daniels over and immediately sees his death stare. Jim looks up and sees John coming back from the grove. He calls out his brother's name. John quizzically stares at his older brother, then slowly falls sideways, landing on the other side of a fence. Jim runs to John's side, but his brother is dead. Lull's bullet severed John's jugular vein. It's amazing he lived as long as he did. All 4 brothers, Cole, 30, Jim, 26, John, 23, and Bob, 21, are suspected of participating in several robberies, including the Gads Hill train robbery. The boys travel in pairs and move around continuously. They spend little time in their home county, but occasionally stop in St. Clair County, where they visit friends, including the Snuffers. For the most part, they spend their nights in the McFerrin Negro Settlement, 3 miles southeast of Monongah Springs, where you stay with John McFerrin and his wife, Hannah, who work for the Younger family in Jackson County. The McFerrin home is a safe haven until the Pinkertons begin to close in. Severely wounded, Lull, still claiming he is W.J. Allen, gave the following statement to the coroner's inquest. The Youngers said detectives had been up there hunting for them all the time, and they were going to stop it. John Younger then lowered the gun, cocked it in a threatening manner. I concluded that they intended to kill us. I reached my hand behind me and drew a number 2 Smith & Wesson pistol and cocked it and fired at one on horseback. And my horse, frightened at the report of the pistol, turned to run. I heard 2 shots and my left arm fell. And then I had no control over my horse. At the time of the gunfight, Lull's mind may have been consumed with the fate of fellow undercover Pinkerton agent J.W. Witcher, who was found murdered near Kearney, Missouri, only 7 days earlier on March 10th. It is rumored Jesse James and others got him. Just 3 months prior to this road battle, the Younger surprised a posse from Appleton City who had ridden to Monongah Springs to capture the brothers. Taking the offensive, the Youngers captured the posse and confiscated their weapons, but after a stern warning, the Youngers released them. Perhaps the Youngers intended to do the same with Lull and Daniels. We will never know. Aftermath, odds and ends. Jim Younger removed his brother's pistols, watch, and other personal effects. Mounting John's horse, Jim asked a neighbor who had witnessed the fight to take care of his brother's body. Then Jim rode up Chalk Road in the direction of Detective James Wright had fled. Unable to find him, Jim returned to the Snuffer cabin to ensure John would be buried properly and then headed south to Arkansas to inform his brothers, Cole and Bob, about John's death. Incredibly, Lull wasn't killed outright by the shotgun blast to his shoulder and arm or the pistol shot to his chest. Found by a farmer, Lull was taken to a nearby cabin and later that evening was placed in a spring wagon and driven to Roscoe. A town doctor declared that the wounded detective would live, but after several days, the Pinkertons reported Lull's condition had worsened and he died. Many in St. Clair County believed this to be a ruse, and that the detective hadn't died, but that he just needed protection from the Younger's wrath. In spite of this rumor, hundreds of Chicago policemen attended Lull's funeral, and the former captain, or an empty casket, was laid to rest in a spacious Chicago cemetery. After filing a report with Sheriff Johnson in Osceola, Detective Wright was never heard from again. John Younger was first buried under a large cedar tree near the Snuffer cabin, where his shallow grave could be guarded. Later, his body was interred in the nearby Yeter Cemetery. The Snuffers and friends buried John at an angle, with his head pointed northwest, so they could later recognize the grave. They were afraid to mark the grave lest the anti-Younger faction came to desecrate it. 2 years later, Jim participated with his brothers, Cole and Bob, in the botched raid on a Northfield, Minnesota bank. Jim was badly wounded and captured in the Hanska Slough shootout 2 weeks later, as were Cole and Bob. He served 25 years in prison, was partially pardoned with the restriction that he had to remain in Minnesota, and committed suicide in 1902. Recommended. The forthcoming Illustrated Life and Times of Jesse James by Bob Bowes-Bell, coming this holiday season. True West Magazine, September 2023 edition. The legendary Four Sixes Ranch by Johnny D. Boggs. The ranch was founded 155 years ago by men and women who are as mythical as they are real. Ranching has always been something of a gamble. So it makes sense that Captain Samuel Burke Burnett was one of Texas's famous ranches in a poker game. Of course, when you're holding four sixes, that's a pretty safe bet. Makes sense, sure. It just didn't happen that way. The poker hand story is a good one, says Henry Chappell, author of 6666, Portrait of a Texas Ranch. But like so many great stories, it isn't true. The truth isn't quite as exciting. When Burnett bought 100 head at Denton Creek in 1868, the cattle already wore the 6666 brand. The bill of sale transferred the cattle and the brand to Burnett. But the ranch, roughly 266,255 acres today, with headquarters in Guthrie, and Burnett have remarkable stories, and the 6666 keeps making history. In December 2020, the 6666, also known as the Sixes, went up for sale with a $320 million price tag. Last year, filmmaker and native Texan Taylor Sheridan, whose ranching expertise comes primarily as creator of Yellowstone and its Paramount Network spinoffs, headlined an investment group that bought the ranch. Though the sales price was not disclosed, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported it at $192.2 million. Asked about the price, Sam Middleton, owner of Chas S. Middleton and Son, LLC, which represented the Sixes in the real estate deal, says with a laugh, "Can't tell you." The Sixes has 119 pastures, 18 solar wells, 29 windmills, a top-line quarter horse program, and all those cattle, Angus these days, spread out among three divisions that include the Guthrie headquarters and the Dixon Creek Ranch near Panhandle, Texas. This was a turnkey operation that included half of the minerals, all of the cows, all of the horses, all of the ranch equipment, the rolling stock, the tractors, the trucks, trailers, furniture, and the big house, and the art, Middleton says. There was another key to the sale, though. Everybody, Middleton says, wants to own a piece of history. That history begins. Born in Missouri on January 1st, 1849, Burke Burnett grew up as a farmer until a late 1850s drought sent the family to Denton County, Texas, where Burnett's dad switched to cattle ranching. At age 19, Burke bought those Sixes cattle from Frank Crowley. A year later, he married the daughter of Fort Worth's First National Bank founder, and son, Tom, was born in 1871. After the couple divorced in 1892, Burke married Mary Couts, another banker's daughter. But after their son died in 1916, Burke had his wife declared insane and confined to a private home. Burke was better with cattle, having escaped the panic of 1873 by holding a herd driven to Wichita, Kansas over the winter, then selling the beef the following year for a $10,000 profit. He was, Chappell says, the right man at the right time. I can't imagine that anything like the Sixes could be put together today. He had the acumen and resources to weather the horrific droughts and market fluctuations of the 1880s and 90s by negotiating grazing leases on Comanche land. Those negotiations led to a long friendship with Comanche leader Quanah Parker, who taught Burke the Comanche language. The Comanches called him Big Boss. Burnett also hobnobbed with Theodore Roosevelt. Burke wasn't just a cattleman. In February 1889, the Fort Worth Daily Gazette reported that the cattle baron brought from his ranch what he asserts is the largest thing in a way of a hog that this state has ever produced, weighing more than 800 pounds. The hog was auctioned off in Wichita Falls for $50. In 1900, Burke bought the 8 Ranch from the Louisville Land and Cattle Company near Guthrie, named after W.H. Guthrie, a major shareholder of the company. 3 years later, the Dixon Creek Ranch, named after buffalo hunter Billy Dixon, near Borger in the Texas Panhandle, was added to the holdings. In 1910, Burke bought the Triangle Ranch, 26,000 acres in Iowa Park. In 1917, he splurged on a modern home at the Guthrie Ranch, built of the beautiful red sandstone with architectural trimmings of white Texas rock, the Star-Telegram reported in 1921. Larger than the most elaborate Fort Worth home, one room measuring 30 by 40 feet. The interior is a constant reminder of pioneer days, but with electric lights and modern furnishings, so it completely lost any vestige of the crude, primitive cowboy architecture. On the frontier. The Six's headquarters might have been modern, but King County remained frontier. A lack of conveniences was mentioned in 1934 by the Associated Press. Today, there is not a single mile of railroad in the country. There is no practicing physician, attorney, or dentist, no resident minister, bank, undertaker, hotel, or organized corporation. When a resident of King County falls ill, medical attention can be had only by going to Lubbock, more than 100 miles away, or to Knox City, Benjamin, or Paducah. Sometimes a doctor is called to make the long trek from one of those points into the county. The same problem comes up when a dentist, attorney, or undertaker is needed. Banking is carried on with institutions in Benjamin or Paducah mainly. Some take their financial matters to Spur. There never has been a bank in Guthrie. That hasn't changed. Closest bank, Paducah, roughly 28 miles north. No true gas station, but the Four Sixes supply store does have a pump, says Joanne Shipman, librarian at the Guthrie CSD and King County Library. Restaurant? Nope. We used to have the Rock Cafe, which was attached to the gas station. Graves, Texaco, I believe, Shipman says. We do have a coffee shop, so you know where our priorities are. King County's seat is designated as an unincorporated community. Shipman estimates Guthrie's population at 50 or less. But people live here, Shipman says, because it's a sweet little place. The county's population is an estimated 259. Of Texas's 254 counties, only Loving, population 100, give or take a couple, is smaller. Tom's Path. Burke Burnett died in 1922, a year after oil was discovered on the Dixon Creek property, 47 years before oil was discovered on the Guthrie Ranch. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram called the estate probably the largest ever to enter Tarrant County records, reporting the property value at no less than $6 million and with a maximum value of $15 million. The will provided son Tom $25,000 a year. Burke's widow got nothing, but she sued, receiving $3 million, and willed it to Texas Christian University. Tom and his father had a very difficult relationship, Chappell says. Most of the estate went into a trusteeship for granddaughter Ann Burnett. Burke did bequeath $50,000 for the beautification of Burke Burnett Park, which he had established in Fort Worth in 1917. Tom Burnett likely had a closer relationship with his grandfather, banker Martin B. Lloyd, who died in 1912, and left his grandson with cash and one-fourth of his properties in Wichita County, land that would also have oil underneath. Two trustees were appointed to manage the estate's holdings, according to the will, but Tom had learned the cattle business as a line rider and later wagon boss. He married Olive Ollie Lake, who gave birth to a daughter, Anne, in 1900, before the couple divorced. By now, you might notice a pattern of a lack of wedded bliss in this family. Says Chappell, Burke was a businessman. Tom was a rancher and a much better horseman. Tom was also driven out to out-earn his father. He didn't get there, but he bought more ranch properties, took an interest in banking, and proved successful in many ventures, except when it came to marriages. None of his five attempts lasted. He sponsored rodeos, bred horses, befriended Will Rogers, and was host to Theodore Roosevelt on wolf hunts. He grew fat and died of a heart attack in 1938. Kingdom of Horses. While Tom Burnett sought to increase his fortune, the Six's foreman, George Humphreys, set out to improve the ranch's run-of-the-mill remuda, Chappelle says. But Tom Burnett helped that cause, too, by gifting Humphreys a stallion named Scooter. Another of his studs, Gray Badger II, bred Six's mares and set the ranch's horse program on the course that led to further improvements under foreman J.J. Gibson, and finally to Doc Blodgett's innovations. So in that regard, Tom made important early contributions to the Six's remuda. Today, that quarter horse program continues to thrive. The annual Return to the Remuda Cell, held with Pitchfork, Tongue River, and Beggs Ranches, Chappelle says, may well be the most prestigious sale of the year. The Two Anns. Tom Burnett's only daughter, Ann, inherited her father's eye for good horses and good cattle. She helped found the American Quarter Horse Association and became the first woman honorary vice president of Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association. After her death in 1980, she was inducted into the American Quarter Horse Hall of Fame, which she also helped establish. Following the Burnett trend, her first two marriages ended in divorce. Though number two to stockbroker James Goodwin Hall produced one daughter, Little Ann, later Ann Marion. Husband number three died in 1964. Husband number four was Charles D. Tandy of the Tandy Corporation. I see Ann Tandy's period as one of continuity and stewardship, Chappelle says. Upon inheriting the entire Burnett empire upon her mother's death, Ann Marion's tremendous resources and intense devotion raised every aspect of the Sixes, genetics, infrastructure, management, to levels that set the standard in the ranching industry. The Sixes was her passion to the end of her life. Ann Marion, four marriages, three divorces, assumed leadership of the Sixes in 1980. Trustees had managed the Sixes since Burke Burnett's death. She was more than just a ranch leader during her 40-year run as ranch owner. She donated $57 million in 2013 to a Fort Worth emergency shelter. Her $10 million gift from the Burnett Foundation helped found the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe, New Mexico. But you can do those kinds of things when your net worth is $1.1 billion, according to Forbes in 2009. Marion was inducted into the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame in 2005. She died of lung cancer on February 12, 2020, at age 81, and her will specified that her ranches would be sold. Guthrie's 142,000-plus acres, Dixon Creek's 114,000-plus, and the 9,200-plus at Frisco Creek in Sherman County. Selling history. Middleton had become friends with Marion after handling several real estate deals for her. But the Middleton name was pretty big in West Texas, too. The fourth-generation company traces its roots to Charles Middleton, son of a Louisiana sugarcane farmer, who struck out west at age 17 to enter the cattle business. He rode into Lubbock in 1898. When the cattle business dried up, he was hearing about ranches for sale, and he started selling some ranches around 1920, Sam Middleton says. The firm, specializing in farm and ranch sales and appraisals, has sold several historic properties, including Texas's Matador, Palo Duro, once part of Charles Goodnight's J.A. Ranch, and Wagner Ranches. 90% of my business is selling these worn-out ranches, Middleton says, but every now and then I get to sell a glamorous one. This is how the Six's sale came about. 4-5 years before Ann Marion died, Middleton said. She said, Sam, when I pass away, all the ranches are going to be sold, and you'll be getting a call. I said, Ann, what about Wendy? Marion's daughter, Ann Wendy Phillips Grimes. And she looked at me and said she could look at you all over, And she said, "Sam, why would I want to burden her with that obligation?" The new era. That obligation belongs to Taylor Sheridan, who isn't the first Hollywood celebrity with a Sixes connection. In 1975's McIntosh and TJ, Roy Rogers' last movie, he played a veteran working cowboy who takes a job at the Sixes. The movie was filmed on location at the ranch and in King County. It's Rogers' best acting performance. A historic ranch and Roy Rogers, Sheridan is stepping into some mighty big boots. The giant legacy of the Four Sixes' historic ranching neighbors. The Four Sixes has tons of history and stories, but so do many other Texas panhandle ranches. We asked Natalie Bright for her take on some of those spreads. Bright isn't just a Texas writer, blogger. Parts of the ranch she runs once were under the turkey track, she says, and we now share a fence line with the Sixes. Charles Goodnight agreed to vacate the lush Canadian River Valley, and in return, the Pasteurs agreed to avoid the Palo Duro. In the fall of 1876, Goodnight drove the buffalo out of Palo Duro Canyon to make room for his cattle. Taking on Scottish partner John Adair, the J.A. Ranch grew to 335,000 acres, covering four counties. Goodnight experimented with buffalo cattle mixed breeds. Turkey track. J.M. Coburn was a Kansas City bank employee who returned to Scotland, raised money, and formed the Hansford Cattle Company. Retaining the unique brand of a previous landowner, he began buying up neighboring ranches and hired a general manager. The GM was killed by lightning. The cowboys rebelled, and Coburn hightailed it back to Kansas, none the wiser on how to manage a cattle operation. Wagoner. The largest ranch in the U.S. under one fence included more than 1 million acres and spanned six counties, growing to 60,000 head. Dan Wagoner even struck a deal with Comanche chief Quanah Parker for grassland and helped fund the building of the Star House on West Cache Creek for Quanah's wives. Dividing the holdings between three children, Dan took it all back in 1923 to form a trust where the heirs were board members with no authority. Litigation among the family extended for 25 years until its sale in 2016. XIT. The XIT was established through a trade of 3 million acres of public land for funds to build a state capital. This deal shifted pastures grazed by New Mexico sheep herders to cattlemen. The first to issue 23 written rules for its cowboys, and it held the last recorded trail drive in 1897 from the Texas Panhandle to Montana. Trail driver Ab Blocker is the man credited with designing the XIT brand as a deterrent for rustlers.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.